I'm Shauna Ritter, and welcome to WFIU's Profiles. Profiles is a weekly program that introduces members of our community, as well as notable visiting artists, scholars, and entertainers to the WFIU audience. I'm pleased to say that our guest today is Dr. Audrey McCluskey, author, former director of the Black Film Center Archive, professor of African American and African Diaspora Studies, and director of the Indiana University Neil Marshall Black Culture Center. Welcome, Audrey.
Thank you, Shauna.
I wanted to start out by asking you a little bit about your background. Where did you grow up?
Well, I'm a child of the South. I was actually born in Valdosta, Georgia, but at an early age, well, around 10, we moved to Miami, Florida. And I finished high school there, went to Booker T. Washington High School. From there, went to Clark Atlanta University in Atlanta and on to Howard University, Washington, D.C., and finally to Indiana University, where I received my Ph.D.
How did you come to choose IU Bloomington?
Well, as a spouse, I think that's true for so many people here. But it also offered an opportunity for me to pursue the things that I wanted to pursue in a more leisurely fashion. We had three boys, and that, of course, was a priority. But it also allowed me to go back to school and to finish my Ph.D., and here I am.
What was your area of study specifically?
I started in education, particularly Black women's education and activism. And so that's what my original field of study has been, and I published in that area, in addition to adding on film later on.
Did you have any specific heroes from that area?
Of women?
Yes.
Oh, definitely. In fact, that's been a privilege to be able to study some of my my heroes, in particular Mary McLeod Bethune, whom I did my dissertation on. As a child growing up in Miami, Florida, we used to have what was then called Negro History Week. And one of the things that we would do was our teachers would have us to research a particular Black leader, a Black figure. And my sister, not me, my sister researched Mary McLeod Bethune, and she actually dressed up like her. She was a kind of a matronly woman, and my sister did her best to imitate her. And I was just fascinated by learning some things about her. And also, she was a Floridian. And so from that childhood experience, I was just intrigued by her. And so later on, as I learned more, I became more interested in her in terms of scholarship because I thought that she had not been really scholarly presented. She had been presented as a kind of a very shallow but somewhat influential figure. And I wanted to dig deeper. And so from her, I went on to other women, and so that became really one of my areas of, I shouldn't say expertise, but certainly one of my areas of interest.
What was it about Mary McLeod Bethune that sort of made her a hero to you? What kinds of characteristics, traits, or accomplishments?
Because she started with so little and gained so much, and plus she had a sense of herself that presented herself in the world as though she belonged. She never apologized for who she was, and she tried to teach others to just carry yourself like a queen or a king and don't compromise for anything.
And what is she best known for in history?
She started a school that grew into Bethune-Cookman College. In fact, she was the first Black woman to be president of her own college and perhaps one of the first women ever to do that. And she started with $1.50, which I thought was a kind of a folklore, but I found out actually in my study that she basically had nothing.
Wow. What took you then from studying historical figures into the realm of film?
Well, certain happenstance, but also a longtime interest. Phyllis Klotman, who was the founder of the Black Film Center Archive, you may have known her. She retired. I was in a department. I'd had an interest in using film and studying film and incorporating it into my own lectures and to in my own study. And it was just an opportunity, actually, for me to become acting director. And I really loved what I was doing. And I guess others thought that I was doing a competent job. And so I actually became director and served in that capacity for about 7 years.
You've taught classes in film
as well.
Oh,
yes. I teach a course now called Africana Women Filmmakers and an introduction to film class.
What are some of the things that you think is very distinctive about the way that blacks are represented in film has changed over the last, say, 25 years?
Well, when you say changed, we need to say from what?
Good point.
To what? Because film itself, as you know, is a very powerful medium, and that's one of the reasons I was attracted to it. I can remember actually going to the movies in the South, and because that was a kind of a cheap entertainment, but also coming out feeling like I didn't know what I was feeling, but I felt uneasy about some of the representations, you know, that I saw on the screen. And so I realized, without having the words for it, that film was teaching me something about myself that made me feel not good at all. And so I think that in terms of African-American representation in film, it has been a kind of pedagogical experience. In other words, it's taught America how to view black people, and oftentimes in a very narrow and stereotypical way. And so when you say, how has it changed, we have to first acknowledge what is there and what has been there, and to see whether or not we have actually changed.
Do you think we have changed?
There has certainly been more access, and you see that all the time. You know, there are black film stars. I mean, Will Smith dominates the screen. He dominates the world in terms of his marketability. In terms of the representation of types, you can see certain changes, certainly. I mean, the fact that you have blacks playing heroic roles now. But underneath that, I think that's more problematic, particularly in terms of African-American women. One of the characters that has become a kind of iconic figure is the character of Mammy, which was in Gone with the Wind, for which Hattie McDaniel won the first Academy Award by an African-American woman or African-American in a major role or a supporting role. But if you interrogate that or ask what are the characteristics of Mammy, be the nurturer, but primarily a nurturer for the white family, not for her own. And then you say, if that characteristic has changed, then are black women on screen today doing some of the kinds of things that Mammy did back in the day? And I think you can still see that African-American women generally are shown as nurturers or either the B word or the H word, some narrow confinement in terms of their characterization. So although we have a lot to celebrate, Halle Berry won the Academy Award, but she won in a very kind of stereotypical role. So it's a measured success. We have more filmmakers who are African-American. We have more women behind the camera. And so there's a lot to celebrate. But we also should question a little deeper the representations that are still there.
You're listening to Profiles on WFIU, and our guest is Dr. Audrey McCluskey. Tell me a little bit about some of the research that you did when you were looking at especially women educators and other heroes of yours in that area.
Well, some of them just in terms of making people aware of who they are. I mean, most people, if they've studied any African-American history, would know the name Mary McLeod Bethune, but they may not know Lucy Craft Laney, who was a mentor to Mary McLeod Bethune. It's a woman that I've recently published several articles and book chapters on. She was in Augusta, Georgia, and she started a school that was sort of the antithesis of what Booker T. Washington was proliferating over the South, and that is the industrial education, because it was felt that industrial education prepared blacks for their designated roles in society. And that was the money that came into the South for black education, were for those industrial schools.
Would we now call those sort of vocational ed?
Vocational, industrial, yes. So the the Northern Philanthropy really ignited that movement, and Booker T. Washington was its leading spokesperson. But what if you wanted to teach classical education? What if you wanted to teach Latin and higher math? You had to really maneuver around the powers that be. And so I admired Lucy Laney because she was able to do that in Augusta, Georgia, of all places. She had a school, which was Haynes Institute, that she started. She got some funding from the Presbyterian Church. And she established a curriculum that had some of the industrial education, some of the vocational education. But it was primarily to keep the dogs at bay. Uh-huh. Meanwhile, she was teaching Latin. She was teaching various languages. She was teaching Black history, you know, and this was in the 1920s and 30s. So you find those kinds of women who were very courageous in their own communities. Some of them had national profile. Some of them did not. But I always found that intriguing.
And we rarely see them represented in film or media.
Exactly.
One of the pieces of music that you picked today was Mahalia Jackson's Trouble of the World. Tell me a little bit about why you chose that as one of your favorite pieces.
Well, I grew up listening to Mahalia Jackson. My grandmother loved her when Mahalia would sing, and she was considered the world's greatest gospel singer. She sang at Dr. King's funeral. I mean, she sang in Imitation of Life, the second version of Imitation of Life. But my grandmother, I think, had a sense of knowing that there was certain strength that came out of the faith that Mahalia Jackson represented. And this is a Negro or Black spiritual. And to me, it speaks of the fortitude that one had to in order to endure. It wasn't so much otherworldly, which a lot of people misinterpret Negro spiritual to be. It was about dealing with this world and the kind of moral and spiritual strength one needed in order to get through the day.
Soon we'll be done. Trouble of the world. Trouble of the world. Trouble of the world. Soon we'll be done.
We've been listening to Mahalia Jackson's Trouble of the World from Gospels, Spirituals, and Hymns. Tell me a little bit about when you first arrived in Bloomington. When was that? When did you first come here?
We've been here about 30-something
wow.
years, so a long time.
You raised three sons here in Bloomington?
Three sons, yes. And they were all very young when we came, and we moved from Cleveland, Ohio. And I grew up in Miami, Florida. I went to school in Atlanta and Washington, D.C. So I had not really experienced a small town in Indiana. You may not know this, but Indiana does not necessarily have the most progressive reputation out there in the world, particularly in terms of African Americans. And so I came with some trepidation, you know, about how it would be to raise three sons in this small community.
Had you heard about sundown towns? Was that something that was
yes.
widely known information?
Yeah,
I'm thinking of James Loewen's
yes.
book.
Yes, we'd heard about it, and we also heard things about folklore, but still, you know, it was out there, those perceptions that this may not be the friendliest of environments for raising three Black sons. So I came with, you know, armed with the idea that I was going to have to be very involved as a parent and make sure that they had images and representations that affirmed who they were and are. And so that was sort of my introduction. But I found, actually, the fact that we've been here so long, that Bloomington is a very accommodating place. It's a place where you can reach your potential. You know, it's a place that has relative safety. But as a parent, you still, I think, have to not give your children over to any institution, but to be aware that it's your responsibility to see that they're educated well.
And where have your sons ended up? They're grown up now, all of them?
They're grown up. One is here in town. One received a his degree from Morehouse College and went on to UNC, and he has a doctorate in philosophy. The second son went to Harvard and received a law degree from Stanford. And the third, the youngest son, also went to Harvard and he received an MBA from Stanford. And they're all doing different things. One is an attorney, of course, and the other is starting his business. So we've been quite blessed to have three wonderful sons.
So you and John have something to gaffel about.
Oh, yes.
How did you come to be a professor from being a student? What was that like to go from being a PhD student at the same university to now being a professor and director of the New Marshall
Center? Well, I had taught before. I taught at Cleveland State University. I taught part-time. And I received, I have two master's degrees, basically, in African studies and in English. And so I had taught. And so teaching has always been something that, a kind of a vocation as well as an avocation. I love teaching. So it wasn't quite the radical change that it seems to be. It's always been a part of my DNA, I think.
And how is your teaching experience, your experience as a parent, your experience as a student influenced your directorship at the Neil Marshall Center?
If I knew how I could dissect that, you know, into equal parts, I guess I could answer it better. But it comes as a package, and I think I represent all that I have experienced, good and bad. And so it would be difficult to kind of parse it out that way, but I feel that I'm blessed and very lucky and privileged to be able to affect the students and students' lives, to be in this wonderful university. I feel nothing but joy about the experiences that I've had. But I'm also aware and see myself as a citizen of the world, and I know that all is not well in the world. And I try to impart that to my students so that they won't be so cavalier about the kinds of things that they take for granted.
We talk a lot in education about the issues of retention, that we are able now to attract more students of color to the university, but there's still, if you look at statistics, a lot of difficulty in terms of retaining students. What do you think are some of the things that the Neil Marshall Center or other programs on campus could do to help make sure that we become a much more diverse student body and that we retain students here to finish their degrees?
That's a good question. And I wish I had a magic kind of elixir that would work on everybody. But what we try to do is to kind of heighten the contradiction between the rhetoric of diversity and the reality of diversity. The rhetoric is always out there. It's out there, diversity, diversity, diversity. What does it really mean on a day-to-day basis in terms of how we live our lives, who we interact with, who's in positions of power and authority throughout the university? And those are questions that oftentimes get shunted aside. But we are very good at performing diversity, but not really living it. And so one of the things that I try to do at the Neil Marshall Center is recognize that students come from different backgrounds, different experiences, and IU may or may not be welcoming to them. You can't assume that just because someone is here that they really feel a part of the university or that they claim it as their own. So we've started, just in the years that I've been here, a Black Student Orientation Week. And during that time, we try to introduce Black students to the Bloomington community, the IU community, and also the resources that are here for them, be it spiritual, be it within the church, be it within other organizations, introduce them to Black business, Black leaders, let them know about the resources in the university, how they can call upon those resources. Oftentimes, Black students don't always utilize all the resources that are there for them. And so we have to do a better job of making them feel that they belong here, first of all. In fact, we adopted the motto that the Neil Marshall Black Culture Center is where you belong, not in a narrow sense, but you belong to this whole university and this whole university is yours to claim.
I know that in the area of cultural responsivity, we talk a lot about cultural lenses that people wear, that we all look out of different lenses that are determined by the culture that we bring along with us. How do you think we can continue to amplify our vision out of those lenses, not only for students of color that you're giving resources and access to opportunities for, but for folks that work at the university who don't have experience of being, quote unquote, a minority population?
You've often heard, and this is a cliche, about your comfort zone. Mm-hmm. I mean, we all like them and we feel validated within them. But we only grow, I think, to the extent that we're willing to step outside of them. And in our daily lives, I think we can just ask the question, you know, how am I affecting the lives of others with whom I interact? Am I just staying with who I know and what I know and what I want to do? Am I trying to extend myself and my horizon? Most people just don't ask that question. And so they remain within their comfort zone and nothing changes. The status quo wins.
Mm-hmm. So a little self-reflection, a little discomfort.
I think that's important. We oftentimes have people come, staff, people, they tell us or ask us a question, what do you do at the Neil Marshall Center? You know? And I ask, how long have you been here on this campus? And they say, oh, I've been here 10 or 15 years. Have you ever come to the Neil Marshall? Well, no, I know it's a nice building. But they don't come to see. They rather you just sort of tell them or come to them and say, this is what we do. And they take notes and that's it. So I think it really is incumbent upon individuals to reach out of their comfort zone, to make themselves aware of what else is going on in this university and not think that just because you have a Neil Marshall Black Culture Center that your work is done. It's just beginning.
I'd like to listen in on another one of your musical choices, which is India Arie's Ghetto from the album Testimonies, Volume 2. Tell me, Audrey, why did you pick that specific song of India Arie's?
Well, I love India Arie. I also love Lauryn Hill and some of the other neo soul musicians. But this one, Ghetto, I think it reaches out to a global world. It's not just the idea of ghetto that we think is inner city, but it's a ghetto of the mind, you know, something like I was saying earlier, but also that it's a worldwide issue that most people live on less than we spend for lunch. They live on that for maybe a year, or at least in Nigeria, where I just visited, even though it's rich with oil, the average person lives on a dollar a day or less. So again, it's about trying to take responsibility for our world and trying to affect some change, even if it's small, on a small scale. And so India Arie and this song, Ghetto, I think, kind of heightens our awareness of those rural issues.
There are places in Havana that remind me of Savannah, parts of West Virginia that might as well be Kenya. Parts of New York City, parts of Mississippi, parts of Tennessee look like another world to me.
You're listening to Profiles, and our guest is Dr. Audrey McCluskey.
Production support for Profiles comes from Smithville, a locally owned business serving central and southern Indiana since 1922, with residential and business internet, voice, and security services. Smithville, local pride, global technology. Information at smithville.net. And the Funeral Chapel of Bloomington, providing funeral and crematory arrangement services for the chapel, church, and graveside. The Funeral Chapel, to honor and commemorate. 333-4400 or online at pdcfuneralchapel.com.
Audrey, you mentioned traveling to Nigeria recently. I know you've also spent quite a bit of time in South Africa. Talk to me a little bit about your experience of the first time you ever went to Africa and a little bit more about your more recent travels.
Okay. Well, the first time I went to, I think South Africa was my first trip to Africa. And it was just after the post-apartheid, Nelson Mandela presidency was just ending. And there was just so much optimism, so much energy, so much hope. And I've been back to South Africa now, I think about 3 or 4 times. And in fact, my most recent book is about film culture in South Africa. And for me, it was not, someone asked me this, did I feel that going to Africa was like going home? And I had to reflect upon that because initially, you know, before we actually went to Africa, there was a romantic view of Africa, particularly in the 70s or so, about Africa as a homeland. And I still believe that. I still know that there are things that connect me with my African past, particularly issues of faith, certain other kinds of issues that are just kind of intangibles. But I also realized, particularly upon travel, that I am, for better or worse, very Americanized. And that in Africa, I feel that I belong. I feel at home, but it's not home.
You spoke in an article that I read about South African cinema, which is what your new book is about, and that themes of reconciliation, memory, and social justice are prominent. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
Yes, and it's not necessarily, there's a theory about that. There are expectations, there are aspirations. Many of them have been unmet as a result of the post-apartheid era. Having lived through the apartheid era and having so much hope in the new era, there was a lot of pent-up emotions about how things were going to change. Things have changed, certain things have changed, but a lot of things have not changed. In fact, if you go by some estimates, some things have gotten worse for people. So this idea of reconciliation is one that has many dimensions. It's not just white-black. It's haves and have-nots. So it's a complexity that I think we need to appreciate when we think about what's happening in South Africa and in other places like Nigeria as well. It's complex. And it's not easily solved. Certainly, we know about corruption. And oftentimes we want to say that it's just these corrupt officials. But it starts longer, or way back in colonialism and neocolonialism. I mean, who controls the economy? So these are complex issues that I think reconciliation, although it's a noble concept, and the fact that South Africa was able to change democratically without a war, a civil war, those are things that we should admire. And so South Africa can teach us a lot about that. But it's an incomplete task because it has not been accomplished, but it's still an aspiration.
A lot of what you've said has really made me think about that in order to understand present situations, we have to understand the context that those have arisen from. And you talk about the fact that so much of your work is motivated by the promise of the civil rights movement. Talk a little bit to me about how, as a young person, that motivated you, especially coming from the South, the civil rights movement, and what part it still plays in the way you are and the way you see the world.
Yes, growing up, I saw this on television. I saw some of the things that were happening. I wasn't a participant in it because I was a little young for that. But I saw the dogs and the hoses being used on people. I remember being in Valdosta even at a young age where there were signs that said, you know, you couldn't use this fountain or... So it was a part of just growing up, seeing how divided the society was. And so I think by the time that I got to college and I started to study some of the people and find out more about it, it was just that this is what I have to do for my personal sense of being, but also to understand some of what people had gone through and how they still remain so optimistic about the world. I mean, if you think about America and the fact that for 400 years you had people in slavery here, But yet the proponents of democracy, black people have always really believed in it. They've never given up on America, even though a lot of people would say America had given up on them. And so it's that that I wanted to study. You know, what keeps people believing? What keeps people going?
What do you think does keep people believing?
I think it has a lot to do with their faith. This is why I started with Mahalia Jackson. You know, it was not so much about faith in a very abstract way, but it's about faith in what the possibilities of who I can be, a better me, a better person, and how I can use that to affect change in the world.
I found out just recently that you were actually at President Obama's inauguration and you were invited to be there. Can you talk to me just a little bit about what that must have, what that felt like for you to be there?
Well, I don't know if I felt so special since I was surrounded by 3 million others of my closest friends. But my husband and I were able to go, and it was, I think, I never forget that for many reasons, but also because it was so cold. I think it was the coldest day of the year in Washington, D.C. But yet, the sense of pride, the sense of possibility, something that we never could have imagined was happening. So it was just a joyous moment in our history and a transformative, a possibly transformative moment in our in the history of our country. So I was very happy to be there. But I realize, and I certainly see it now, that it was just that moment. It does not change everything. It was a moment of possibility. And it moved us from where we were to where we are. But there's still a lot more to be done.
Talk to me a little bit about what you saw as Obama's rise from someone who was a fairly obscurely known politician who had had one moment at the 2004 Democratic convention and then suddenly was the presidential candidate, it seemed like. How did you see that evolving over a number of years?
It's something that I think scholars are going to be studying for many years about how Obama was able to do what he did. And I think there are many things that contributed to it. I mean, he's a very special person, very intelligent, very politically astute. But there had to be really a kind of a perfect storm of events and possibilities to make that happen. And as I look at Barack Obama, I realize that very few others could have done what he did. And so the fact that Obama understood that, in fact, that he wrote about it in his two marvelous books, shows that he understands America and all this racial animus. He understands it, and he's been able to use it to his best effect. He's not a descendant of slaves. It's interesting that, given our history, that the first black person would not really be a descendant of slavery. And I think that that made it possible for him. Because he was somewhat removed from it, but he still understood it. The other thing that Obama had going for him is that he has a biracial background. And that may seem to some people to be alienating. But one of the things that I think Obama does very well is I call him the conciliator in chief. He brings people, he sees himself as bringing people together. He can understand his grandmother. He can understand, you know, blacks in Chicago, because he has that ability to see both sides of a situation. And he was also able to market himself as something that America did not expect from black men. He always smiles. He's always happy. He's not angry. He was able to capitalize on all of those things. And I think it was just a moment in time, the fact that we'd had a nightmare of 8 years of a president, the war. There's so many things that just made this moment possible.
And I think you said that it is the moment of the beginning of possibility, that
yes,
marking his election. I think there's a fairly widespread idea that this is the culmination of the civil rights movement is the election of President Obama as compared to the beginning of possibility. What do you think the media needs to do to make the case that this is the beginning, not the end?
Well, you see what has happened with Obama, I mean, since that wonderful day, is that he was giving a very short leash. And now, of course, he's being blamed for almost everything. Some of this, I think, he predicted very well. And also, it's just so many contradictory instincts in our American culture. On the one hand, we see ourselves as benevolent, altruistic, and we are. But we also have some very deep-seated racism within this country, and you see it exhibited every day on the internet. You see all the kinds of things that they're saying, turning the White House into the Black House with the watermelon patch. That's still there. It's still a part of America.
Well, and data in education shows that we're still not meeting the needs of many students of color.
We're not. And so that's why, I mean, it's the beginning of a possibility. At least you have someone who kind of who understands and sees all the various ways in which we are still an unequal society. Whether he's able to act upon all of it, he's constrained still by a power elite that is still in place. And so I don't expect that. This is why I say possibility, because I didn't expect change overnight. A lot of people did, and so they're disappointed now, but I'm not. Because I realize that the kind of maneuvering, the kind of negotiation that he had to and still has to do every day. And so I understand. I see how he's graying now, but it still was a wonderful moment and a moment that I never saw coming.
You've talked a lot about how your time in Africa has led you to now really be researching the African diaspora and have become, well, if not an expert, have expertise in that area and be teaching in that. How did you move from African-American history to specifically the African diaspora? I know there's a natural connection, but talk a little bit about what took you there.
Well, I think through film, because the Black Film Center Archive, I mean, began thinking primarily about African-American film history. And during my tenure there, I wanted to expand it to the diaspora. And so I started looking at film in Nigeria and South Africa and elsewhere and began to extend and expand our collection to include the works of other throughout the diaspora. And so it was a kind of a natural evolution.
Okay. One of your other song picks is Sarah Vaughan, Send in the Clowns. Talk to me a little bit. You have obviously a very eclectic taste in music. Talk to me a little bit about Sarah Vaughan in your life.
I just love music. I love jazz, blues, so much gospel, some classical. I mean, but Sarah Vaughan, to me, what else can you say about it? She's the most wonderful expression of vocal artistry that I've ever heard. And this particular song, even though it's not her song, I think it's a Judy Collins song, she claims it. And I think you can just see that resonate in her voice. And so this was, to me, a perfect example of artistry, vocal artistry on display.
Isn't it rich? Are we?
You're listening to Profiles on WFIU with our guest, Dr. Audrey McCluskey. Audrey, talk to me a little bit about some of the current work that you're doing in terms of research. I know you've just had a book come out very recently that you started to speak about the African diaspora in film.
Yes, that one's called The Devil You Dance With, Film Culture in the New South Africa.
Where'd you get the title?
Well, it was one of the interviews that I did with a filmmaker, and he was talking about the various challenges that he has to overcome, the obstacles that he has to overcome in being a filmmaker at this particular epoch in South African history. And he characterized it as a devil that you have to work with. And so I just remembered that and liked it and played with it a little, because there are so many different things that are happening right now in South Africa that's affecting the film culture. The fact that even though South Africa is probably the richest country in Africa, the film industry there has a long history of importing other films. Mm-hmm. And so if you go to the multiplex, you're likely to see whatever you see down at the show place, rather than see indigenous South African films. So that's a problem. That's an issue that we talk about in the book as well. But the title came from that kind of negotiation with what is there and what needs to be done. And that's the devil.
Uh-huh. I was just struck by that. What are some of the other areas that you touch on in the book?
Primarily access. You know, how does a filmmaker get established? What kind of support he or she gets? What are the issues? What are some of the themes? Like we talked about reconciliation, whether or not South African history would be something that filmmakers want to continue to talk about. A significant portion of the South African population, particularly among white South Africans, feel that they've been there and done that. They want to move on. A lot of the black South Africans feel that they need to, just like some African Americans, we need to deal with enslavement before we can really totally move on, because America's never really acknowledged the hurt, not only hurt, but certainly the injustices of enslavement. And so some black South Africans feel that white South Africans need to acknowledge that before we can move on and just turn another leaf. So this is something that artists in the society will deal with, whether they are filmmakers or whether they are whether they are writers or whatever, that they have to somehow deal with this issue of reconciliation and memory before we can, in fact, quote unquote, move on.
Do you think in general art, and especially film, reflects where society is or actually instigates change?
That's a chicken and the egg story, but it probably does both. It does both. Because, I mean, think about the films that are most popular in America. You know, are they really films that point us to a different direction, or do they kind of celebrate where we are or talk about where we are? And you could obviously find both. But the ones that are most popular are usually the one that confirm people in their beliefs.
What role do you think Crash has played in reflecting change or instigating change?
I don't know. That's a question I don't know, because the audience for Crash is kind of like the choir in church. You know, they're already converted. Mm-hmm. I don't think you get too many new people in to see Crash. I mean, it did okay in the box office, but
even though it won Best Picture.
Yeah. I mean, that's still not popular acclaim. That's kind of critical acclaim.
Okay.
And there's a difference.
Talk to me a little bit more about that difference.
It's a difference between a film that has all the right stars in it and a film that, you know, is about Transformers. Something, but it makes more money than the one that has all the stars.
Not transformation,
no. And so it's that's why we call it popular culture, because it sort of, to a certain market, a niche market, that it really is about.
In the last few years, you've come out with a number of new books. You've become the director at the Neil Marshall Center. You've traveled to Africa. You've traveled to Cuba. You've been very busy. What are your aspirations for the next few years?
Let me say something first about summing it up, because I'm not really good at that. I'm not really good at sort of saying, okay, now I've done that, let me do this. I'm kind of opportunistic about things. I kind of react to things that I see. And I don't always, Bethune always said that, I don't stop to plan. Well, I do plan, but I can always change my plan if I see something more interesting. So that attitude, it doesn't sound like, you know, very thought out, but it's kind of kept me new about what I'm doing. If I see something that I really want to pursue, I'll pursue it. You know, life is short. So I kind of go with things that really, to me, make a difference. I don't think I have to follow a script. And that's a luxury. I know a lot of people don't have that. But things that are interesting to me, like my book on Richard Pryor, you know, I always admired his work. But I never thought that I would do a book on Richard Pryor. But I ended up doing a book on Richard Pryor, you know, because of the opportunity to do it and the fact that I was fascinated about something behind the man that we often saw and laughed with. So that's how I like to see my life, as being kind of an unfolding of opportunity and being able to see those and to somehow maximize the possibilities within.
You have been listening to Profiles on WFIU. I'm your host, Shauna Ritter, and our guest has been Dr. Audrey McCluskey. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a joy.
The program you have just heard was recorded in August of 2009. The studio engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Production support for Profiles comes from Smithville, a locally owned business serving central and southern Indiana since 1922, with residential and business internet, voice, and security services. Smithville, local pride, global technology. Information at smithville.net. And the Funeral Chapel of Bloomington, providing funeral and crematory arrangement services for the chapel, church, and graveside. The Funeral Chapel, to honor and commemorate. 333-4400 or online at pdcfuneralchapel.com. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. Information about Profiles, including archives of past shows, can be found on our website, wfiu.org. Profiles is a production of WFIU and comes from the studios at Indiana University. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. Please join us again for the next edition of Profiles. For WFIU, thanks for listening.